It's really lovely to be here at the LBC. I was here when I was quite newly involved in the movement, and I was here when it first opened in 1978. Spooty asked me to do the catering for that opening week, and I was living in Norwich, so I came down for a month, and I stayed 11 years in and around Bethnal Green. So at one point I managed the cherry orchard next door, and which isn't the cherry orchard now, and helped set up Bodywise. There was three of us who set up Bodywise. So some of you may remember those businesses. And actually sitting here, when I came in earlier, I couldn't help it. I was just looking at these wall hangings. Now, for many of you, this won't mean anything, but these brought such memories back, because I thought, gosh, they're still here. My friend Anjali, I think Chintamani did the cartoon and she made it. So as Mitch was on a retreat in the work period, we'd have to cut these little pieces out. And I still remember cutting them out, sticking them down. And I looked at it, I thought, gosh, the blues, that used to be a deep blue. And this, all these pinks were blues. And the top was blue. So it's obviously been mended over and over. But this wonderful person, Anjali, she died in October. And in fact, Anjali is part of my talk, because there were four of us who, as you'll hear, sort of spearheaded this project. And it's just lovely, actually, to come in here and see they're still here. I can't quite sort of believe that they're still hanging there. Now, I don't know you at all, and I just wanted to ask a few questions before I start, and I'm really happy for you to ask me questions as we go along. You know, if you say, oh, I must ask her that, just ask, and I might answer it then, or I might say, oh, look, can you remember that? Come back to it at the end, because I'm not going to say a huge amount. I want us to, you know, sort of interact. I want to know what interests you about what I've said or whatever. So I'm just curious, though, who we've got. So has anybody here, is anyone a Mitra? You know, have you had a Mitra ceremony and become more involved? Thank you. And has anyone asked for ordination? So a few, great. And has anyone been, say, to Tara Loka, the Women's Retreat Centre in Shropshire, been on retreat? Anyone being on any sort of retreat, weekend upwards, anywhere? So most of you have had some experience, okay, of being like away on a residential retreat. Great.
And there's somebody completely new.
Yes. I've met a couple of people who said today it's their first time coming to the class. I said, oh, it's mine as well. So, and you're completely new. Great. Okay. Well, don't be afraid to say, what are you talking about? You know. Because if I say something and you don't know, then I'd much rather just stop me and I can explain. So you have to go back in your mind. You have to imagine, imagine when there was no London Buddhist Centre. This was still a derelict building in the 70s, 1970s. I know that's before some of you were born. But the movement was so small, you know. I came along, we were the FWBO then, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, so now Tri Ratna. And I can remember coming along to my first meditation class, my first weekend retreat. And I thought this was huge, you know, I thought there was a big organisation behind these two guys running this weekend retreat. And I learned later on, well, there wasn't, because that's how we think, isn't it? We come into contact with something and you think, well, there's something big behind it. But there was no LBC in those days. There were no retreat centres. There was no Tara Loka. There was a Padmaloka, a building in Norfolk. And Sangharachita Bante lived there. And it became a men's retreat centre. So there was that building. And actually, that helped the guys develop a lot of retreats. But the women, we had nothing, actually. We rented different places. We did have a little farmhouse called Mandarava in Norfolk, eventually in the late 70s. So there were hardly any centres. So it was this very young, new movement, and there was an awful lot to do. And we all wanted it to happen, you know, immediately. So I was thinking back, and I thinking, gosh, you know, the 70s, 1970s, 1980s, hardly any women got ordained. I mean, that was how it was. So there just weren't many. And Sangharaksha did all the ordinations, men and women. And I was thinking about it on the train coming down. I thought, well, because the guys had Padmaloka, in a way that just helped them organise retreats. And once they got retreats, people had an experience of, you know, you've all had that yourself, you've been away, and you start to sort of, the practice has an effect, a deeper effect, and you start to see, yes, you know, what can happen. But for the women, it was very sporadic. And there could be several years with no ordinations at all. And then you get one, you know, and it was absolutely amazing because one woman was ordained. But of course, as soon as one got ordained, like, there was loads of more centres opening up. There were city centres. So, you know, there was lots of needs there to be met. Lots of things you could respond to. And something had started in a very small way in the late 80s. Vidyashri, Sangadevi and Ashokashri had begun to run two retreats at Taraloka. So Taraloka was opened in 1985. And that was a big event for us because it had been, a woman had left us a cottage, and we'd managed to sell that cottage, and that became the deposit. And this Shropshire farmhouse without buildings, it was barns that hadn't been converted. And it was all converted by women working together. And that had a huge impact, actually, on, we could see, you know, actually, people, we really wanted to do that and created that place. And at Taraloka, which was just for any women at all to come along, it's still really successful, really popular. These three, Vidyashri, Sangadevi and Ashokashri, ran two retreats a year for women who'd asked for ordination. And they had to invite, you had to be invited to them. One was a month and one was 2 weeks. And we had this terrible title, POP, Samavahita, was on the pre-ordination retreat, that's what it's different. But it was absolutely awful because I can feel my buttocks clenching, actually, even as I'm describing it. Because you'd be invited on one of these retreats and then the team was kind of like eyeing you up, you know. Is she ready? Are you ready? And you'd feel like, you know, sort of, you had this one chance to say, yes, I'm ready for ordination. I mean, it wasn't quite like that. I am joking a bit, but that certainly is an element of it. So what the problem with that is that there weren't many of those retreats, and they were sporadic. So there was two a year, and you met different women order members. You didn't meet the same team of women. So you might see them for 2 weeks, and then you go back to wherever it was you lived and worked, and you wouldn't see them again. So there was very little continuity. In fact, there was hardly any continuity. So it took quite a long time. Sangharaksha was still doing all the ordinations. So ordination was a bit of a mystery, really. I mean, how did it happen, you know? How did you know if you were ready? How did order members know if you were ready? How did Sangharaksha know if you were ready? How did it all come about? It was just like, well, one day, eventually, it might happen. Yeah, I can remember knocking on his door several times, saying, I'm ready, I'm ready. And he'd go, no, I don't think you're ready, So that's just a little bit of a sort of context. Very few women becoming Dharmacharinis. And a movement really expanding. So in 1991, myself, Dharmadina, Anjali, and Anomar had been invited to one of these retreats at Taraloka. And we were the team with Ashokashri, Sangadevi. And it was a month, it was one of the month retreats, invitation retreats. And Taraloka, the barns, hadn't been fully converted then. And we were in a caravan at the end of the barn. And we used that for our team meetings. And I can remember the team meeting, where it happened. Don't ask me what we were talking about. I really don't remember. But I can remember it was like this caravan just sort of metamorphosed into something else. And you could tangibly sense that the four of us said yes. And we didn't know what we were saying yes to. We were on the surface saying yes to forming an ordination team for women. Because what we were saying yes to was actually we really, really, really in our hearts wanted to help women become members of the order. That was, I knew what that felt like to have that as a heart's desire of my life, what was most important, what was meaningful. And we said, yes, we'll do it, whatever it takes. We didn't probably use that phrase, whatever it takes, but that's the phrase that comes to me now. Yes, we'll do it. Because the other three who were doing these two retreats a year, they were fully occupied with what they were doing. And in a way, you know, one of them was chair of Tara Loka. They weren't free to do it. Well, in a way, the four of us weren't free to do it either. It took the next year and a half to free ourselves up. Actually, I was the only one who I'd left the LBC at that point, and I was living in Cambridge, and I was looking for what to do next. But so in a way, I started the sort of whatever it was we had to do, it doesn't really matter at that point. But the others, it took them 18 months to free themselves up. And then we decided to start fundraising after that. So thinking about this little talk, I've got three headings. One is stand up. So stand up in the sense of really standing up yourself, putting your head above the parapet and saying yes. So it's like a going forth or a standing up. Yes, I'm going to do this. So it's a very individual response. The other heading is stand alone and stand together. So what was actually needed back there in the early 1990s was a quantum leap. And we didn't know, certainly I never had in my head, what that was going to look like. But we said yes. We were going to do whatever it was we had to do. So what was important there was that we each responded to that need, that we had to do something to meet women who'd asked for ordination on a regular basis. They had to meet the same group of women so that we could get to know you, you could get to know us, and we'd kind of in a way mutually understand what this process was about. And as soon as we'd done that, the four of us, I remember we just made a completely open-ended commitment. And I remember we had a little talisman that I found, and we buried them. When we disbanded, we buried those talismans. It was like we were not going to put a time limit on it, which is actually really unusual. I'd never done that before, and I've never done it since. So there was just no time limit. And along with that came a tremendous feeling of freedom and initiative, because in a way the road was completely open. It was completely up to us to discover, well, what did women need? We knew women needed something, and this ordination process needed to happen, but we didn't actually know what that would look like or what it was really needed as part of that. But we did know that it meant setting up regular retreats, a retreat centre, living together, working together. Well, we had lived together, the four of us, in a community in Amaravati, in Wanstead, many years before, about 14 years before, but we'd never worked together. And actually, we didn't, although we kind of knew each other, we didn't in that last sort of 12, 13, 14 years. We actually hadn't, our lives had been in very different places, so we really didn't know each other that well. And some of you, you know, you may, well, has anybody had an experience of living in a women's community with Tree Ratner? Ooh, one or two, okay. Well, I can remember when I first heard about women's communities, I was absolutely convinced, and this is no offence, I'm not very PC, but I was convinced I'd have to be a lesbian. And I was absolutely terrified. So no offence meant to anyone here of whatever, you know. Yeah, you'll tell me off if you'll tell me later. But I was, that was what I thought, because I thought, well, women together, you know, it just hadn't really been in my background. Anyway, by then, by 91, I mean, I knew that was, you know, ridiculous. Didn't have to worry about that. But living and working together on a project is a very intense experience. Fascinated to know, if, you know, later if anyone of you have had a similar experience like that, and we'll come back to that. So standing up, this individual response, it also meant that although the four of us knew each other, and there was one person I was particularly friendly with, and I really wanted her to be part of it, looked up to her, had huge expectations of her, as it discovered, which was well done dinner. The thing was, we couldn't do this because it was a friendship thing. That was one of the things about deciding to do it together. In a way, it was kind of good we knew each other, sort of. But I'll come to it a bit later. I realised that it wasn't doing it because the others were doing it. Because as soon as a difficulty arises, if that's your reason, if that's your motivation, then, well, you either sort of step back, then sort of compromise, or you can leave the project, and I'd had experiences of that. Or one person's vision overrides the others. And what was different about this is that we all responded to a very particular need. We had a common vision. We didn't have the details, but we certainly responded to a common vision. And it was bigger than any one of us. It was bigger than our individual connections or friendships. And it was that, I've realised, that allowed us to work with the difficulties and the polarisations. And there were certainly a lot of those in the years to come. So that's standing, just standing up saying, yes, I'm going to do this. Standing alone is about standing alone as an individual as part of that project. It was about standing alone as a team doing it. And it was also about standing alone in being prepared to then ordain women oneself. So originally Sangha Devi was with us, but she moved on into back. Up to Birmingham after a while. And I think this whole project drew, it had to, by the nature of it, because we were setting up something that didn't exist. It drew forth loads more than any of us expected. And I think I've said it's because this commitment was to something bigger than any of our individual relationships, then it meant we could sort of really support each other and also, yes, overcome the difficulties. I'll come back to the private precept. Standing alone as a team, what I mean by that is that when we all said yes, we immediately started to think, well, where are we going to run these retreats? So where are we going to live? How are we going to do it? So we knew who was going to form this team. The four of us would be the core of it. But where was it going to be, and how are we going to do it? So, of course, we soon started thinking, well, Tarloka is a very nice place, you know. And it had these barns that needed to be converted. And I remember trying to convince Dayanandi that it would be a good idea that we actually were at Tarloka, but it soon became very clear that the project was going to be bigger than Tarloka could cope with. So it would either swamp Tarloka, we'd lose the value of that retreat centre, and we decided that that would be too big a loss. And I'm glad we never went down that avenue. But what it meant is that, well, we were starting from scratch, so we had nothing, we had no capital, and we had to support ourselves. So we started to run a series of retreats, more retreats, for women who'd asked for ordination. The four of us would run them. And we started fundraising. And we started a property search. So I can still remember the letter. I wrote a letter in another caravan at Tairaloka, which was the office. Sent it out. We sent it out to the whole movement, men and women, everybody we could possibly think of who had an address. And I can still remember the first two women coming up to me with the first checks. I think they were for about £25. One of them might be for £10, actually, and the other one was £25. And I was... It was astounding, actually, because like this idea had gone out, but it was just words on a letter, and then suddenly we were getting actual people responding. And I can remember talking to some of the guys who'd done fundraising. You know, they had Gujiloca by then. They'd had Gujiloca in Spain for the ordination retreats for some years. And he said, oh, you know, you must have big amounts. You're going to have big donations. You won't be able to raise all this money just by small amounts. Well, we'd never had any big donations. I think at that point, you know, there were some men who had a lot of money and inherited, were fortunate, but there weren't women with lots of money. And we did it, actually. We did do it. So we started a network of fundraisers in all the centres across the UK. It was difficult from abroad. They wanted to send money, but the exchange rate was hopeless. So we mainly focused through the UK. And we had a network of fundraisers, people doing all sorts of things, and we would run Christmas shops. And we raised a third of the money that we needed through that sort of fundraising. And then, bear in mind that the four of us, we'd been here in East London in the early days, and it was all squats and short-life housing. We'd never owned property ourselves, so I mean, none of us thought in terms of, heaven forbid, mortgages. I mean, that was a word that hadn't even entered my vocabulary at that stage. And even loans, you know, loans. Oh, no, I never thought about loans. I mean, not at all. You know, this is another universe compared to the world today, isn't it? I mean, I feel I'm talking about some other planet, you know. And so we had to sort of think constantly bigger and bigger and bigger, because obviously we realised, oh, we're going to need a big property. The figures, in a way, it doesn't really matter because, you know, it's all different amounts now. But probably it was like £1 million in the end that we had to raise from these first two cheques that were handed to me. And there were two older members who were really, really great. They both had got money, and they'd both... two guys, and they'd both been very generous, and I negotiated a loan rate with them. I said how much we needed to borrow, and I said what rate of interest I thought we could pay. And they were great. They lowered it by 2%. They were so great. And with the third, so third was in loans. Most of it was from those two guys, and then other people, we had about 15 to 20, it was all women, the others, with like interest-free loans or short-term loans. So, you know, we agreed to pay those all back within 10 years, which we did. We paid all those ones back, and the two guys, it was a slightly longer. And then the third amount was a Triodos mortgage. So we'd got this relationship with Triodos Bank by then as a movement. And Triodos is a fantastic bank, ethical bank. And they, the director came and gave a talk at one point to the chairman of centres, and I was there, and he just talks about money as energy. So, you know, he says, well, you think you give the bank your money, and you think that's your money, you know, and they're looking after it for you. But, you know, as soon as you hand it over, they've spent it. And he was just brilliant at freeing up our whole mindset and thinking about money and what you can do with money and how we sort of our attitudes to it. So all the time, those 4 years, it was just like, I can remember my mind just going bigger and bigger over the scale of the project, the amount of money that we needed to raise. And we started property searching. So again, you have to imagine, we were given a car. It was a VW Polo, two-door, with a hatchback. rather battered little white polo it was. And I bought a suit to go and view properties. I thought, well, I better look the part. I had this suit, and I'd arrived at VW Polo. Well, it wasn't too bad me arriving on my own, but when I would sort of look through hundreds and hundreds of properties, and I'd have to work out, well, you know, I had a list of boxes. I'll tell you about in a minute what the boxes I had to get ticked. And then I'd sift through them, and of course, a lot of them I realised, you know, not big enough, whatever, not isolated enough, not beautiful enough, too much money, whatever. Come down to a short list, and eventually that short list, I'd probably go and see them myself, and then I'd get an Omar, Dandin, and Anjali to come with me. And for some reason, I mean, we used to wear the weirdest clothes back then. I mean, I can remember an Omar and Anjali, you know, leaping out, and we'd have travelled hundreds of miles up the M6, because it was always Scotland or Wales, because property was cheap and it was big and, you know, it's beautiful countryside. So we'd have driven for miles and miles and miles in this car. Omar and Dandin always in the back, they didn't drive, so Anjali and I were always the drivers. Of course, they'd be like really fed up. Right where we were, and they'd leap out, and they had this thing about bright yellow oilskin raincoats, and I can remember they kind of like whiz around these houses, and the very first property I remember I took them to was this wonderful house in the Borders near Dumfries, and it was a beautiful, and they were sort of Scottish landowners. The house was absolutely divine, and it had cottages, and it had outbuildings, it had 1,000 acres, which we didn't want, but this other guy I'd got into contact with wanted the land, and we wanted the house and the buildings. And they were running all over this house, and I couldn't control them. It was so funny, and I could see this Scottish, you know, landowning couple in their tweed, sort of, thought they're not going to sell it to us. So, you know, I mean, it was unfortunate if the owners were there, because they the other kind of place we'd look at would be a big country house. There was one in Wales, a couple in Wales actually, and then they'd been taken over and they were run as either, you know, hospitals or old age care homes or some sort of institution. And I can remember the one near Mould, which was quite an appropriate name to be near. And it was completely empty and had this fantastic carved wooden staircase, you know, as you open the big doors. But my God, you'd open these big doors and you're probably with the estate agent because nobody was living there. And the dry rot smell that hit you in the face when you open these doors, it was absolutely awful. So I got quite good at recognising smells of wet rot or dry rot. And I used to carry a screwdriver around with me, you know, even if the owners were there, you know. Any suspicious looking wood round the windows, you know. I can think. So obviously if we were serious about something, we had a proper survey. But, you know, we were very much sort of, we were living, giving ourselves peanuts. We were still in that sort of era where we didn't spend the money on ourselves, and we weren't going to spend money on a survey unless we were really, really sure that this place was going to be it. It seemed to go on forever, the property search. It didn't. It went on for 3 years, and it was amazing in the end what turned up, because I'd got to rock bottom with the list of places and nowhere new was coming up. And then T. Ratanaloka at the Cluddock House actually came through an order member, a Dharmachari. His father was looking after it. It had gone into receivership, been run as a conference centre. So some of the boxes that places had to tick, you know, had to be in beautiful surroundings, quite isolated, but very accessible. You notice the contradiction. So I used to have, in those days, you could have a book of all the railway times in the UK, and I used to trawl through and work out a railway timetable so that people from Scotland, from Cornwall, and Holland, so I sort of include Holland and France. Yeah. Everybody could get here within a day. We had a criterion that nobody had to stay somewhere overnight, so that anybody could get there. And it had to have a room big enough for a shrine room or an outbuilding, you know, that we could use as a shrine room. Um, had to have land, but not too much land, and had to have reasonable heating. I mean, I won't go into the heating systems that we looked at, but they were, some of them were absolutely, I remember the main one I saw, it had a whole building to itself. I couldn't believe it, you know, the boiler room was enormous. And, well, you can imagine, can't you? I mean, we just didn't know about these things, the four of us. And one of the things about that, standing alone as a team, you know, I did get a lot of good advice from guys who'd done it, although the fundraising, they were completely wrong, and we were right. but the sort of fixing a building, it had to be almost ready to move into. We knew that we weren't aiming to have a retreat centre like Tariloka, which, you know, took several years, and it developed itself over those years with teams coming and doing the work. That wasn't part of it. What we wanted was somewhere that we could almost move into, immediately have retreats, because, you know, more and more, well, when we formed our team, the numbers of women asking for ordination doubled, and it just kept growing. So we needed to hit the ground running, really, and Aberclough Accounts was fantastic for that, because it had been a conference centre, we had to do very little to it, and it worked really well. It was in the beautiful Brecon Beacon, so I'm really pleased that we went for that. Yeah, so out of that also, standing alone, what was happening, totally unbeknownst to me, and I don't think the other three realised either, but all this fundraising, property searching, coming, deciding to live and work together to create this team, had some other purpose. And I remember once Sangharakshita saying, well, you know, who do you think is going to be ordaining people? And I said, well, you are. It was obvious, you know. To me, I was only 6 years ordained when this project started. And Omar Dhammadina and Anjali had been ordained anywhere for 14 and 16 years, I think. You know, they'd had a lot of experience in the order. And when Bhante asked that question, because I went and told him, I said, we're going to start this team. We're calling ourselves the Women's Ordination Team. Very good, very good. And, when he said, well, who do you think is going to be ordaining women? I mean, I hadn't imagined that far. But so what he was saying, by setting up your own retreat centre, yes, having to fundraise from scratch, doing it, you'll get spiritual weight. So that was what he put in the pot. And I can understand in retrospect that everything we were doing, it did take us deeper and it did give that weight. So it also showed him that he could really rely on us. And I mean, I still struggle to get to grips in a way with the movement as it is today, because it isn't, in a way, it's not the movement I sort of had my formative years in. Of course I accept it, but it's like, I know I'm getting old, you know, and old people, they kind of like think back to earlier days. And that was a really significant step for him, seeing that us doing all this, it benefited women. Obviously it had its own purpose, but it helped him be able to trust us. And so then, yes, he began asking. Anjali was the first person who he asked to ordain women. I think Dhammadina was the next, I think I was the next, and then Omar. And from there, it really meant, yes, we could really expand outwards and really sort of break through what I used to talk about as a bottleneck. And I can see that what we did really created the women's wing we have today, because, you know, women now are ordained in 10, 15 women on a retreat. It isn't so longer such a sort of, there is a sense of a mystery to it, but it's not such a mystery. And it really changed the landscape of the order. So I think that becoming the private preceptors, we develop that trust in ourselves because we knew we could do it. We weren't relying on anyone else to come and do it for us. We really knew we'd done this ourselves, we created it. And Bhante's trust in us as well. He could see through what we'd done. So it was trusting ourselves and also his trust in us. So the standing together was really us running, working as a team. So all the time we were fundraising and property searching, we were running, going for refuge retreats, first at Tara Loka, and then we commuted up and down to Dharnakosha in Scotland, whilst also fundraising and looking for property. And, you know, it wasn't that all this time we got on. It would be remarkable if we had, you know. but what happens, it was so intense. We were together 24 hours a day. So, I mean, you get to know each other, warts and all, and all your childhood conditioning comes out, much to your humiliation and embarrassment at times. And mine seemed to come out over meal times. and all your expectations of each other, completely unrealistic expectations, and they get in the way. And you don't know that they're there until suddenly, boom, you know, you're suddenly in a polarization. And you think, what's going on here? So we really did see ourselves and each other. But we really trusted each other. And again, that was because we hadn't stood up and said yes, because of our friendship in particular. You know, that was there. It was a part of it, but it wasn't the overriding factor. And particularly my friend Anjali, who I'd known for 39 years, she and I, my goodness, I mean, we were like chalk and cheese, and we really, really polarized. And I don't have another friendship like it, and I've never shared the intensity of experiences with one person that I shared with her. And that project, that 13 years, well, because what we were doing required us to communicate, it required us to cooperate. We were often left running the long ordination retreat at Il Convento when Dhamma-Dinda's mother was dying and she had to keep coming back to the UK. And it would be hell. You know, here you are, you're running, for heaven's sake, you know, you're leading an ordination retreat. And we have an argument, you know, we hit one of these polarizations. Well, what do? You actually have to dig deeper. You actually have to let go of whatever it is you're holding on to. And we had to do it loads. It wasn't just once. And we did it. You know, and at the end of each Il Convento retreat, we could genuinely rejoice in each other. We really rejoiced in each other's merit. And it was quite an experience. I know I still have people come up to me and say, "Oh, I remember that retreat. You know, I was ordained on that retreat. I remember." Because at Anjali's funeral in November, there was quite a lot of people came to Cambridge. It was fascinating times. And all that, trust in each other as a team, because discussing if somebody was ready for ordination. No one of us could have said yes. We trusted each other's perceptions because we related differently. You know, one person would draw something out of a person, but another one of us on the team would draw something else out. You know, we were responding to different things. Plus, we didn't all know everybody. As the numbers grew, we couldn't possibly. So I think, I don't know, I'm not. How long have I been talking?
Oh my goodness, ages.
Oh. Yeah. So I'm going to stop there. I am going to stop. I'll just wind back as a way of winding up. Eventually, the four of us, original four, did move on because it was unsustainable. But there's a fantastic. Others joined us. Kalyana Shree joined us, Ratnadharani, Maitreyi. And then there's been several new teams at Tea Latin Aloka. And the wealth of experience there is fantastic. You know, it's still a really important place. And I think the whole project, when I thought about this, I thought, oh yeah, how I'd sum it up, spiritual community at its best. Mm-hmm. Because you're alone, I had to make that commitment on one's own, but it was together with other Dharma farers. And that meant we went where we might not have gone otherwise. We might not have dared to have gone, I think. That's the point. We might not have dared to have done what we did. So that's, thank you very much for this.